The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live.
It's a good Tuesday. Thanks for being with us. We are back after we fought COVID. Finally kicked COVID to the curb. I will get into that in a minute. Bob Herrig will be with us with SI.com. Bob, of course, knows Tiger and Phil inside and out. He's written a book about them. Was just at Southern Hills. Want to talk to him about Justin Thomas. Want to talk to him about what is really going on with Phil Mickelson. Like the PGA Championship over the weekend, they did not even address Phil. Didn't even mention him. Like he didn't even exist. And then Tiger and all that too. So we'll have Bob Herrig with us. And then Mike Farren. It'll be good to catch up with Mike. He left the Diamondbacks. He's at Sirius XM. He is killing it. He's crushing it. The Diamondbacks are 22-22 as we sit here on the 24th of May. Did he expect this? What does he like about this team? What doesn't he like about this team? What concerns him? It's always good to catch up with Mike. We'll chop it up too on the Yankees, Dodgers, and everybody else, or maybe if the Mets get through their injuries. So we have a lot to get to with Mike Farren. Jared Nielsen is our chairman of the board. He is the Iron Man. He directs this ship. Even when he's not at 100%, if it crashes and burns, it's his fault. Opening comments brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union, taking care of you, taking care of your business. That is Desert Financial Credit Union. We appreciate their ongoing support. It's like COVID's just weird. Like, I'm double vaxxed. We mask. We try to be as safe as we can. It's gone through all four of our kids. My wife and I got it together. You know when you're standing at the altar and they say, you know, for rich or for poor and sickness and in health and all that stuff, it's all true. And we're standing there looking at one another. It was a week ago, Friday? Yeah. And she's got a COVID test in front of me. She said, you're positive. It was like I was doing my thing. I felt a little off. I traveled. Went to Kansas to move my mother earlier in the week. So I'm on a flight, no one's masked up, but you know, airplanes are circulating around the air, but you're in an airport. And we went there, we dropped her and we turned right back around and caught the next flight back 40 minutes later, same plane actually. So it wasn't like we're on the ground long in Wichita, but we were there on that Monday. And so it's like a 5-day period and I'm at an event, meeting on Friday, and I just started feeling something. You know when you feel something? But by the time I got about halfway home, I called my wife and says, I don't know what is going on, but I feel like somebody took a 2x4 and rammed it through my teeth and right between my eyes. I mean, I was just, and I don't get knocked out. I don't. And I got home, went in the chair, she gave me the test, came back, woke me up. It was like 3 in the afternoon. You're positive. And then 24 hours later, she was positive. And so the two of us were just no fun at all. And this is while the Suns are figuring out a way to crap the bed to monumental proportion with their opportunity to win, and they didn't against Dallas. So, you know, I had to go through that too. And it's just like one thing after the next. When you have COVID, you can't fight through. Like I'm talking, Jordan Hamm had COVID. And I was talking with Jordy about the symptoms. And then there's other people that are checking in with me every day. And they're just, you know, this is what I experience. This is how it is. This is how, and it's just one of those things where it's got to run its course. And it was like I had mono as a kid. And it was like having mono all over again. Just, yeah. And then it turns into the snarfing stuff and spitting up stuff and all that fun stuff. And you try to work. And I couldn't focus, you know. Does this sound familiar? So it was hard. And these people are like, oh, it's nothing, it's no big deal, it's man, just please go away. If you're watching this and you have that opinion, I'm sorry. You might want to turn the channel, you know. It's compassion is not a bad thing. Not everybody's built like you. Let's try to work together through this. So I'm back. I'm feeling pretty good today. I would not say I'm 100%, but I'm a highly paid, trained professional, so I'm going to do my thing. I did watch, well, there's a few things. Kyler Murray, you know, Kyler Murray is not going to win the court of public opinion in May, And I know it's May and there's not much going on for in some people's minds. If it's not the Cardinals or the NFL, then boy, there's just nothing to talk about. That's the furthest thing from the truth here in Phoenix. There's a ton going on. But I will start there because, you know, in May and not showing up at OTAs, Kyler Murray has every right to not do that. And fans have every right to be upset with him. And we have every right to point out that he's not there trying to be a leader of a team. But is that stuff all overblown and overvalued in this day and age of just show up, shut up, and play in September and win football games? You know, I think for people like myself, I've seen holdouts through the years. I've seen disgruntled players through the years. And if they show up and they ball out, people forget. And that's clearly the Murray camp side of it. He's getting $5 million, and his quarterbacks are getting $40 million. Seems pretty inequitable to me, but really isn't that hard to show up when, in the court of public opinion, you're not doing well here in Phoenix. Really not been a great offseason. Anybody's going to try to paint the, wow, the Cardinals have had a great offseason. No, that's not true. You're getting a paycheck from the team, or in some way, shape, or form, you're seeing a benefit from being the hype squad around a team. That's not been a good offseason. It's not. Your star receiver gets popped for PEDs. Your quarterback's not happy. You know, it's so, and you haven't replaced Chandler Jones. And I can go on and on and on about it, not being Mr. Negative, being fact. Fact. So if you're in that side of the street, I can take that argument and say, I get it why he's not there. I can also take the other side and say, probably be a good idea if you showed up. Not that hard. Not that hard. But this is what we have here in Phoenix. It's kind of like trying to create the DeAndre Ayton trade market. I could sit here every day and say, you know, there's this website and it is saying that that Kevin Durant is going to come here and that, you know, there's players that their kids have the jersey of DeAndre Ayton, and that means it's going to happen. Yeah, I could do that all day long. That's not going to happen. It's the nonsensical time of the year in Phoenix. First week of 100 degrees, going to get hot. People can't see football, and there's just going to be a lot of stuff thrown around to fill time. I tend to look at things like a 22-22 baseball team, and they're really interesting. They're not great. Like last night, they kicked the ball all around, but I didn't have Christian Walker tied for the National League lead in home runs. Did you? That's really interesting. On the other side, Bob Herrig, SI.com. Bob will be with us. We will get into Tiger. We will get into Phil. We will get into the space of Justin Thomas and much more. That is next on a Tuesday. It's great to be back. Stay with us. All right, as promised, Bob Herrig is with us, SI.com, the author with Father's Day right around the corner, Tiger and Phil, golf's most fascinating rivalry for Father's Day, guys. Make sure you order it and you pick it up. He comes fresh off of Southern Hills, refreshed, relaxed, very few storylines, not much drama, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. In all honesty, where do you even start when you have a conversation on what struck you most from the weekend?
Well, I think we have to be fair and focus a little bit on Justin Thomas. I mean, it was a great win for him, and to come back from seven back, I know he needed some help, but still he had to shoot a great score to give himself the chance. And I think that's why you don't give up. You never know what might happen. And, he had it happen for him. You know, he got in position. He actually could have won it outright if he could have made a 10 footer on 18 Sunday, you know, the way it turned out. I think if that had been the case, maybe, Pereira plays the hole a little bit differently on 18. But still, it was a tremendous effort on his part, a second major, now 15 tour wins, two majors and a Players Championship. You know, it's pretty darn good career, and he's not even 30.
Yeah, I mean, that's Hall of Fame stuff.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
We're looking at, you know, and that's been a topic out here in the golf world, out here in Arizona, is where does this put Justin Thomas? And it's, well, he's not, like you said, to your point, he's not even 30 yet, and he's got a couple of majors under him, and now he goes about his business. That whole story in itself, and it does tie in a little bit to your book, because of who was with Justin Thomas and the irony, I think it was, over the weekend and not having Phil there and seeing Bones and seeing that whole storyline. How did that play to you?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, it was an interesting coincidence in that, you know, Phil won the PGA last year without Bones. Now, they had been apart for several years already. You know, now we've come to learn that, you know, it wasn't an amicable breakup. You know, I mean, to Bones' credit, he actually made sure that it was portrayed as amicable. Mm. You know, he didn't go out guns blazing. He was very, very adamant that it be a joint thing. And, you know, what we've come to learn is that it was his call. It's his decision. He wanted to leave Phil in 2017. And now, as I actually did a story on him earlier this year, and he basically said that Justin Thomas was probably the only guy he'd come out of the, you know, the broadcasting world for to come back and caddy. He loved caddying, but he loved what he was doing. He wasn't going to just come back and caddy for anybody. And it was Justin Thomas. And look what, they're 4 or 5 months into their arrangement, and now they've already got a major. Along the way, there was some frustration about not winning. Mm-hmm. But as we saw, you know, Jim gave him a pep talk on Saturday, and that did Justin a lot of good. Apparently, you know, he basically made it known to him, quit being so hard on yourself. And the result was that big win.
Have you seen a caddy have this much of an impact on someone so soon at this level in covering it through the years, Bob?
Well, you know, it's funny. There's Scotty Scheffler's caddy, Ted Scott. He left Bubba, or they mutually agreed to split up last fall, and Scheffler made a caddy switch at the time. In fact, Scheffler's old caddy is now caddying for Mito Pereira. Mm. So, and you know, he almost got a major, mm-hmm. but you know, Ted Scott goes to work for Scotty Scheffler and he wins 4 times. His first 4. I don't know that that's a coincidence, you know, and I don't think it's any knock on the previous caddy. Sometimes you just need a different voice or a different approach, and he's given him something that's working. 4 wins in, you know, basically 4 months, including the Masters, after having not won yet, although I think we all felt that he was going to, had a great Ryder Cup last fall. So, I mean, that's a pretty good example of somebody having a great impact. But certainly, you know, Bones has had another voice. And listen, Justin's previous caddy, Jimmy Johnson, was really good, too. He had a lot of experience over the years, and you know, he did caddy for him for the early part of his career here with a lot of success. So, but sometimes it's just, you know, it's just making a change. It's sort of like swing coaches sometimes. It has an impact.
There's a few things about Phil, and I don't want to go too far down this, but I do want to mention, again, the book is available. And by the way, Bob said, don't push the book. No, I'm just kidding. but it is available with Father's Day coming up, guys, if you want to check it out. Bob Herrig with us for a few minutes, SI.com. The book is Tiger and Phil Golf's Most Fascinating Rivalry. There was not one mention of Phil that I saw on any of the broadcasts over the weekend. There wasn't even a look back and the defending champ is here. I don't know if that was just me, if I was looking for that intentionally, but I found it rather to be odd. What was the feeling like there on the ground?
Yeah. I will say that Golf Channel and ESPN vetted it pretty thoroughly early in the week. Golf Channel got it out of the way early, like Monday, Tuesday of last week. But you're right, on the weekend, I mean, let's be honest, if Phil was in the tournament, if he had made the cut, if he was anywhere in where they would be showing him, you know, they go back to that.
Sure.
It's just, of course they do. And that's what's crazy about this to me. I mean, it's just like we've gone from this incredible victory a year ago. I mean, if we were talking a year ago today, 2 days after the PGA Championship, you know, all we would be discussing is how great that win was, how history making it was, all the accolades, you know, oldest major champion. And now we're kind of brushing it aside. you know, and I don't mean you and me, but in general, you know, like it kind of got pushed aside. It's almost an awkwardness. You didn't really see Phil's likeness anywhere.
No,
you know? I've been saying this, I've written this a few times in different ways, no matter how we got to this point, no matter what side of this you're on, you might think that Phil's absolutely deserving what he's getting. You might think that this has gone way too far and it's ridiculous. And I've heard that both, but it's just sad that this is where we're at, you know, no matter how we got here. I mean, he's been great for the game for 30 years. You know, he's already been in the Hall of Fame for 10 years. You know, he's in the Hall of Fame before he won at Muirfield in 2013. Think about that, winning two majors after you go into the Hall of Fame. And this was a career sort of legacy boosting win. You know, if there was any doubt about any talk about among the greatest ever, that pushed him over the line. And now he's embroiled in this controversy and we're not really quite sure where it's going.
Yeah, I felt like the broadcasts were getting paid by the word watermaker. And let's see how many different ways we can say watermaker and do features on the trophy. But we're not going to do 1 second over the weekend on the defending champ from 365 days ago. I just found that really, I found it odd, quite frankly. What do the players say about the Mickelson storyline right now?
For the most part, they've taken the high road. I mean, even Tiger did that. You know, Tiger said that he, you know, he thought it was unfortunate that he wasn't there. He's a popular player, great win. But, you know, he made clear, he was asked, he answered, I do not agree with his opinion on this whole thing with the rival leagues and his comments about the PGA Tour. You know, Tiger has made it very clear that he sides with the tour in this argument. But what's interesting to me is, you know, if Tiger really wanted to, he could bury that league. He could bury them. He could bury Greg Norman, all of that, if he came out and was a lot more forceful about it. If he were to, you know, maybe denounce the backing, you know, and whatever, however way you want to do it. He hasn't done that. He's just made it clear where his side is. And that suggests to me that deep down, Tiger and a lot of these guys, there are some aspects of what Phil has said that they agree with. It's just the over the top nature of it, you know, that has made this so bad. You know, over the years, all players have had gripes with the tour. There's, you know, where's the money going? What, you know, transparency? Why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing that? And some of that is what Phil's been saying. And it's just been lost in, you know, obnoxious greed. You know, it's kind of hard to think that there's obnoxious greed when, you know, the tour's entities give millions of dollars to charity every year. You know, they do all kinds of great work in communities. There's all sorts of, you know, local charity money given out. Obviously there's economic impact. I mean, sure. Think about it for your tournament out there, you know, just what that all means, you know? So, you know, is he suggesting that some of that money shouldn't go to that and should be going to him? I don't even know if he is. I think he's just saying they could do better by the top players. And ultimately, if you dig down into this, I think that's where this lies. And his messaging was poor. Talking about using a oppressive regime to get leverage is not going to go over very well. And, you know, but I think Tiger would agree that for all that they bring, ticket sales, TV ratings, sponsorships, you know, when they play, those things go up. They're not getting any extra. You know, if they stand on the tee Thursday, having to perform, getting zero. Mito Pereira, he's the greatest example. He was 100th in the world starting out last week. God love him. He probably didn't sell a single ticket to the PGA Championship. Tiger Woods. Now look, the TGA was going to sell out anyway. It was going to do great. So this might not be the best example, but if it were a run of the mill event and Tiger shows up last minute, they've got to add parking. They're going to sell way more parking. You know, if they're charging $10 or $20 for parking, they're going to make money on that. Obviously, they're going to sell more tickets. They're going to sell more hospitality. They're going to sell more concessions. All of those things go up. The charities make more money. You know, the tournament maybe puts a little bit more money aside. The networks are happy. The sponsors happy. If Tiger doesn't do anything like this week, he withdrew, he gets zero. You know, and I think there is something to be said for the fact that the top guys do bring value that they're not rewarded for. Obviously, the FedEx Cup is huge, but you have to get there. Tiger's not going to be playing in the FedEx Cup this year. He's not going to make a penny. I use Ricky Fowler. He didn't make it last year. Ricky Fowler brings a lot of value. So look, I'm not trying to defend these rival leagues, but I'm sort of just trying to look at, well, what is the player's gripe here? And I think that, you know, deep down, if you dig, you can kind of see that they might have a point in an area or two. But obviously, this thing has been so blown out of proportion and gotten to be so big that I think that message has been lost.
Where was Phil this past weekend? Did you find out?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm guessing he was in San Diego. I saw USA Today went to try to find him. They talked to his mom. They weren't able to get Phil. You know, that's the other odd thing about this. You know, Phil, he released a statement, 6-7 paragraphs on February 22nd. So what are we? We are now almost exactly 3 months past that. He said nothing, zero. I mean, his agent released a statement a month or so ago saying he had entered the PGA, the US Open, and had asked for permission to play in that first live event. Phil's name wasn't on there. When he withdrew from the PGA, it was the PGA who announced it, not Phil. So didn't say a word, nothing on social media. That to me is a little bit bizarre. I mean, at some point, doesn't he have to talk? He could do it with a media friendly interviewer too, like at least to get his side out, which I'm just surprised has not happened.
Yeah.
So now that leads to all the speculation and conspiracy. Is he going to go play that first event outside of London for the Live League? And then this thing really escalates if that happens, because I don't know if there's a way back to the PGA Tour if he does that.
Does he recover? Let's say tomorrow he stands in front of the microphones and there'd be hundreds of them. Does he recover and come back? You know, we're forgiving in society, we like to say, but does the tour already look at Phil and say?
If he goes plays in one of those live events, I think the tour will be done with them. Different people are going to have different levels of punishment for doing that. Like some might just want to go play in one or a couple, and they might be willing to take the punishment for going to do it anyway. If Phil does it after all of that's gone on and he doesn't turn his back on it, then I think the tour is going, they're going to have a hard time bringing him back, because this will always be a storyline and it'll be a distraction at every event he plays. I find that a little bit unfortunate and sad in that, you know, if he could find a way to do both, why not? But they don't seem to be willing to let him do both. And look, down the line, the Greg Norman thing was going to be 14 events. It's only 8 this year, and you're not required to play them all. Listen, one of the great ironies about their argument, Norman's argument, is that, hey, they're independent contractors. They should be able to do whatever they want. He's long maintained, I shouldn't need to ask for permission to play any outside event. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as I fulfill my obligations, if I want to go play wherever I want, if I play the 15 on the PGA Tour, I should be able to go play 5, 10, wherever I want around the world without permission. He's always believed that as an independent contractor. And I have a feeling that they're going to be putting their money where their mouth is in terms of the legal aspect to that. But the great irony is if that league does launch in 2 years, it's 14 tournaments and you'd have to play them all. So there is no ability to just do what you want. You'd have to play all 14, not any 14, just the 14, because they're going to have a team aspect to this. And you couldn't just be dropping in and out. So that might be one aspect that they look at there to make their argument stronger. Because if they could say, hey, look, you're only required to play 7. Okay, 7 of the 14. Okay, well, then playing the PGA Tour also is viable.
Yeah.
You know, you could play their 7, you could play 15 on the PGA Tour. That's 22 events. It can be done. 14 and 15 doesn't really work, you know, and so that's where I just wonder if they might change that going forward. And, you know, it's the lawyers who are going to be the ones profiting big time, I think, as we go along.
Yeah, I mean, can you get Steve Loy and Phil together in a room with their sides and the PGA Tour together in a room with their sides? and some leaders, maybe even on the player side, say, would you all just slow down here a little bit? Are we seeing where we're heading? But, and I was thinking this all the way back in November when Phil was here for the Champions Tour, and, you know, fans showed up like crazy to watch that event, which they wouldn't have done if Phil, to your point, had shown up, and he was great and gracious and gregarious and all that, which he always is. And I asked him about, are you going to play in Phoenix? And he said, yeah, to be determined, we'll see. Well, that was a no. And from that point on here in Phoenix, there's been this was our fair-haired, you know, Amy Sun's cheerleader, Phil ASU, and what is going on with Phil Mickelson? And it's like a different vibe towards him out here now.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a lot of disappointment, I'm sure. Now, this year he missed it, I'm guessing because of the fallout. Well, he had played in the Saudi event the week before.
Right.
But the Saudi event, the Saudi International, had gone up against the Phoenix Open, the Waste Management Tournament, the two previous years. And that's where the original angst came from. When Phil first committed in 2020 to the Saudi tournament, you know, everybody looked at the schedule and realized, you're skipping Phoenix?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, his attitude about it was a little bit gruff. And I'm not sure that he handled that properly. You know, he needed to be a bit more, hey, look, you know, I'm taking this opportunity. I know people are going to be upset. You know, I've played in the Phoenix tournament 30 years or 25 years, whatever. I expect to be back. You know, he could have softened the blow. Instead, he said things like, you know, I might not be playing there anymore. I might be done, and, you know, they'll get over it. It's kind of not the way to, you know, not the way to handle it. And, you know, to your point, he's usually been so gracious and so savvy with what he says. And as it has related to this issue, there's just been some odd things that he said. And clearly there's been something bubbling beneath the surface. I know back over the years, Phil has always felt that the top players are not rewarded enough in terms of, there's too many events, we're giving too much money to the rank and file guys. Instead of having 48 events, we should have 30. If you can't qualify for the 30, too bad. You know, in other words, play better.
Yeah.
Direct that money into the 30 tournaments. Let's prop these up events up, have better tournaments. We're not going to play all 30. We might play 20 of them. Going to have 30 great events, you know, better players. If they can't make it, too bad. And then obviously direct more money in these events. He's always felt that. He hates the idea of these opposite events. You know, basically they're just being subsidized by the tour. This is part of his point. And if he had, you know, sort of explained that calmly and coolly, and, you know, that does make some sense. You know, it does. I mean, where does it say anywhere that they have to take care of people and make sure they have a living? You know, the other sports are ruthless when it comes to that. But golf is, you know, their whole thing is playing opportunities, you know, more charitable opportunities. They try their best to keep fields big. They want to have opposite events when there's a short field event. It's all to give their members opportunities.
Right.
And that clashes with what Phil, who's a star, thinks. It's just, to me, it's very interesting how it's all come about.
Well, one last thought, Bob, and it's just the Super Bowl is here next year. And it's the same week as the Open.
Mm-hmm.
If there's ever a time, and I know Phil has always had the spotlight here in town, and I've been here north of almost 30 years now. Next year, if he's not here for the Open, I would be surprised by that, unless he just decides I'm going overseas, or they're at such loggerheads. But with the Super Bowl in town, that's a Phil made for event to show up and be a part of that. But just my view. Tiger, where is he going to be there in Boston in a few weeks, or do you expect him next overseas?
Well, listen, I have to preface everything I say about Tiger by saying I was dead wrong about the Masters. If you and I had spoken a month before the Masters, 2 weeks before the Masters, I would have said no chance, because he gave all of his own public comments about it, downplayed it completely. And there really wasn't much evidence to suggest he was getting ready to play. The first time I thought it was possible was the Tuesday before Masters week, when he went to Augusta with his son. You know, there was all kinds of chatter about him being there. He played a practice round with Justin Thomas. And you don't go there and do that the week before the Masters if you're not trying to play. Mm-hmm. That was the first time. I mean, that was like the last week of March, like March 29th or 30th or something. That's how late it was before I thought he'd be there. So I guess never say never about the U.S. Open, but I just have this sense that it's going to be a no. The window is much shorter. We're 3 weeks from U.S. Open week. There was 5 weeks between the Masters and the PGA. You know, and there's a sort of a decompression period that he has to go through. Clearly, he didn't feel good enough to go Sunday. He needed to. I get the sense there's a lot of swelling in that lower leg and ankle and foot when he does that amount of walking. And he needs to let that calm down. And then he tries to get in the gym. And I'm sure, you know, he's got therapists and physical trainers and he's doing all sorts of things to try to strengthen it. Somewhere along the line, you got to work on your game. And that means getting back on your feet, hitting balls. And at this point, it just seems like he would be aggravating it some more and it would make it harder. U.S. Open's not going to be an easy golf course either. That's mm-hmm. the other thing. He's coming back at the hardest venues, you know, and you almost wish he would just give himself a breather, come back to some easier courses, you know, even if he doesn't contend or whatever, just an easy walk, a place where he doesn't have to worry so much about hazards and hitting, you know, 530 yard par fours, you know, the shots required over the, you know, and he hit a lot of great ones. To make the cut was a monumental achievement, knowing how much pain he was in. Then again, you know, the harder courses probably suit him and birdie fests probably don't work for him. But my guess would be right now, no U.S. Open, no further setbacks, get ready for the Open, which, you know, he's already said he really wants to play, which would be in 4 weeks after that. So he's kind of got 6 or 7 weeks now before St. Andrews. Then I would think he shuts it down after that, you know, maybe plays his event in the Bahamas in December. And then, you know, if there's improvement, which he seems to suggest there can be, there's a lot of room for improvement, which he's been told there will be, then he can, you know, maybe he plays Riviera next year. Maybe he plays the Players Championship. Those are like a month apart. The Players is a month before the Masters. Getting in some reps, if he's able to do that, then maybe next year we're talking about the things that I think we've gotten ahead of ourselves on right now.
Yeah, the Open, it just seems like you're going to run into cold and wind there like you ran into cold and wind in Tulsa. You're going to run into deep punk. It just feels like, man, if he tries to play here in a few weeks at the Open, it's a hard watch. It's a great watch. It's compelling, sure, but you're almost screaming like, just withdraw, please. And don't go over there. And if it's windy and 50 and nasty and rainy all week, that's not going to go well. So
that's the crazy thing. You know, nobody expected the temperatures we had in Tulsa over the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, you would have thought he would have not had to worry about that. He shouldn't have to worry about that in Boston for the U.S. Open. But again, I just think it's too soon. You're right. The Open, we could get all four seasons in a day over there.
Yeah.
And there's been some raw days, but there's also been, you know, warm days. Both of the times he won there, like he's played there four times as a pro, 2000, 05, 10, and 15. And I don't recall the weather for any of those being terribly cold. It could be, but it wasn't. Like, it was mild. Maybe some days was breezy. You know, there's been opens where it's been really cold, you know, rainy. You know, the one where he had the chance to win three straight majors in 02, that third round was brutal. It's temperatures in the 40s and wind chill that was really cold, hard rain. That is not his friend at this point in time. And we're talking about the back too.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just his ankle, it's in his foot, it's his back. You know, so it's a lot to overcome. I can understand why you'd want to go to St. Andrews, though. That this might be the last time he could play there where he's truly, I mean, you know, the next time would be he'd be in his 50s. You know, where is he going to be at then? Mm-hmm. You know, so I could see why that might be a goal. What you hope is that he's not doing anything that could make this worse. You'd like to think his doctors have given him the okay. Of course, he's defied doctors before. So you know, so much that we don't have, you know, that he doesn't answer. You know, we don't even really know we know that he had two broken bones in his lower leg, but we were never told the exact extent to the injuries to the foot and the ankle. You know, there's a lot of bones in your foot. How many did he break? Did the talus bone, which I've gotten to be way more of a medical expert with Tiger than I ever thought I would be in any walk of life. But that's the bone that sort of connects the foot and the leg and the ankle. If that is damaged or compromised, that's very, very tough to heal. And there's going to be arthritis and things like that. So, but we don't know. We just don't know what happened. So maybe someday he'll tell us in his memoir or something like that. But for right now, we're just speculating.
Bob's book, Tiger and Phil, Golf's Most Fascinating Rivalry, is out, and Father's Day is right around the corner. Bob Herrig, of course, just off of Southern Hills at SI.com. We, as always, appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thanks, Brad. Appreciate you having me.
All right, as promised, it's great to catch up with Mike Fair. And you can hear Mike on Sirius XM MLB Home Plate, Sirius XM College, because it's college baseball playoff time. Mike, of course, sees all, tells all, knows all around the major league. So I figured, you know, when I'm watching the Diamondbacks at 22-22, it's actually yesterday, I sent Mike a text or a DM, said, hey, it's time to talk. So what do you make out of this start to this team, Mike?
I mean, I think it's been pretty encouraging. I mean, I think there are a couple things that stand out. One, for the most part, the starters have been excellent. And while I think, you know, a large amount of that goes to the talent of specifically the top three guys in Gallen, Bumgarner, and Kelly, I think you have to give a fair amount of credit to Brent Strom as well, and the pitching coach. I mean, he's one of those rare coaches that really makes a huge difference in the way he works with guys. He has such an old school feel while understanding how to incorporate new information, just like very few people can. And so I think that's one of the things that stands out. I think the other is that after a rough April offensively, the numbers have been much better this month for this group. And some of that's that, you know, Farshaw got off to a slow start. You know, that probably impacted some of their numbers early. He's been swinging it much better. If you start to look at the power numbers this month, they have ticked up for a number of guys like Peralta and Pavin Smith and you know, Christian Walker, as well as he is hit over the course of the last few weeks. Some of the data says that his numbers should be even better. So I think those are a couple of the factors that are there. And now I'm kind of curious to see how it continues to go from here as you started to sprinkle in guys like, you know, Alec Thomas along with Varshow and Perdomo, obviously having to play a significant amount of time because of Ahmed's injury. Like, you're starting to get some looks at young guys that they hope are the core of what's the next consistent contending team.
Do you think this is sustainable?
It's a good question. You know, I think they haven't gotten the results from their bullpen that the back of the baseball cards on those relievers show. So, you know, seeing Kennedy and Melanson get right, I think, you know, not that Kennedy has pitched poorly, but you know, he'll be a little bit prone to the home run ball just because of the nature of the way he throws. It's a lot of high fastballs, right? So I think that's one thing that could improve. I think for the most part, I don't think that there's going to be a huge drop off with their starters. I mean, I don't know that I expect Gallen to post a Gibson-esque ERA all season, but, you know, Zach Gallen's one of the best starters in the National League. I have some questions on where the impact offensively is going to be long term. But I think it's certainly encouraging. I mean, listen, if they were to keep this going at this rate where they just finished around 500, but out of the mix, they lost 110 games last year. Right. So that improvement of nearly 30 games is pretty remarkable. You don't see that over the course of the season. Even if this team were to lose 90 games, I think it would be a massive improvement. So I don't know if it's sustainable or not. I think the time will tell. I do think that they're in a stretch here where, you know, once you get about a third of the way through the season, you start to identify what it is that you need and what route you're going to take. And if they keep playing well over the course of the next 2 weeks, I think that they could be in a position where they're looking to add versus selling, which is certainly what the anticipation was coming into the year.
Yeah, I mean, you alluded to it. If Melanson and Kennedy and I'll use the term blow. If they didn't blow, I think it's six games now that that they've blown. Mike, they'd be sitting right there near the top of the NL West. They actually led in all four of those games in Los Angeles last week, and then it all fell apart. But after seeing what happened last year and seeing what's going on this year, I could sit there and be Mr. Optimist and say, you know, they're just not that far off from being interesting around Memorial Day, which is what you want.
Well, yeah, I do think that they're interesting. I mean, I think they're going to be more interesting over the course of the season, too. I mean, I think there's, you know, there are one thing that hasn't been talked about enough with this build that they've had of their farm system is that actually are pretty well loaded with arms. And those guys are going to start making an impact, I think, over the course of this season. I think in the second half of the year, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that you see more prospect graduations. Now, I mean, this is probably putting the cart way ahead of the horse, but, you know, Corbin Carroll has been off to an unbelievable start at AA. And remember, he missed almost all of last year because of a shoulder issue. It would not be surprising to see Corbin move to Reno at some point. And then you start thinking about, okay, well, this is a potentially impactful player. If they're in the mix in the second half, do they go to him? I think that's entirely possible. You know, I think that with some of the arms that they have, you know, in Reno, you know, we've already seen Corbin Martin, and he's looked a lot different this year, I think, than he did at any point last year, that they'll be interesting, whether they're in the mix or not, whether this ends up being, you know, a 72-win team or an 82-win team. I think you're going to start to see some of the pieces that they anticipate being part of that group when they're into consistent contention coming and making an impact this season.
You alluded to Brent Strom earlier, and I've been using the line that he's been the MVP offseason acquisition for them. Is there that much? I believe there's that much. His track record speaks to that much. Unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember Stromy when he was a Padre and I watched him as a kid, but he's imparting so much knowledge, wisdom, or kicking guys in the rear end, whatever you want to go with. But can you take us a little further on the Brent Strom piece here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that I don't think that his message is all that different from what a lot of pitching coaches provide. I think his way of delivering it, I mean, communication is huge, right, for a coach. I just think he's really good at communicating. Right. So like there are a couple things that you notice that they are throwing higher high fastballs than they ever have. Right. Like, and that's part of Strom. I mean, even going back to when he was in the Cardinals organization, you know, when he was the minor league pitching coordinator for the Cardinals, that was what he believed. And he was in an organization that was, you know, Dave Duncan was the major league pitching coach, and they believed in two seamers, get ground balls, fastball low and away. And Stromy was a little bit different in that. Now, everybody has kind of gotten to that point. I think he's also really good at taking the information that's provided and making it digestible for players. And I think while the message has always been, we're going to pitch to your strengths and we're going to use those strengths against hitter weaknesses, I think the way he delivers the message probably takes another step forward for players in understanding how to attack. Mm-hmm. So I think all of those things are factors in what makes Brent Strom special. And he is a really smart baseball guy. I mean, I've been fortunate to spend some time around him over the years. And he just has that right kind of way about him. And the other thing is that he's not afraid to teach. And I think some of it is that he has, you know, a reputation that he can, you know, do what needs to be done. But at the same time, like, he's not afraid to go to Madison Bumgarner and say, no, you need to do this, you know, or you should think about this. It's probably a better way to put it is, if you do this, I think this will happen. And because he's had such a strong track record, you're much more likely to buy into it. Right. So I think all of those are factors with Brent Strom. I think he deserves a lot of credit, but make no mistake, the players are the ones who are executing and the pitchers deserve the vast majority of it. I mean, I think Eno Bumgarner's had a couple of rough starts here lately, but they're the ones who deserve most of the credit because they have been executing their pitches at a high level.
I remember listening to you in spring training over on Sirius XM, and you stopped into the Diamondbacks, and it was an interview with Zach Allen. Mm-hmm. And you were talking in a way that I mean, I've listened to you through the years, and you were very, very upbeat and positive about the direction that he was heading, I felt like, in hearing you go down that path. Are you surprised by where he is at this point of the season?
No, I think, you know, I have a great, in fact, I was talking to Zach for a little while yesterday when I was at the ballpark. I love Zach Gallen. I think he's a tremendous talent and exceptional competitor, but he is an extremely cerebral pitcher as well. And I think when you look at a guy who has the mix of pitches that he has, but also is such a student of the craft of pitching, mm-hmm. I really think that that I'm not surprised that he is where he was last year. I mean, he could have put up a season like this last year, but remember, he suffered the weird arm break in spring training when he was hitting in, you know, and then he had the elbow issue, and then he had what I think it was a groin, right? He spent three different times he was on the injured list, and so that really derailed his season. I mean, the stuff's not really much different. There might be a hair more velocity more consistently, but really he's just been healthy and able to execute pitches, and he's got a really good game plan, and he's got somebody that he can bounce ideas off with Brent Strom that allows him to get the most out of it. Not to say that he couldn't do that with Matt Hergis. I think, you know, he had a good relationship with Hergy. I would assume Hergy's a really easy guy to get along with, but I just think he's maturing as a pitcher, and I think he's healthy. And so, no, I'm not surprised he's been one of the top starters in the National League. He's always had that stuff and that mindset to be able to do it. And now he's executing at the level that he needs to.
Mike Farron with us. Before I get you out of here, you can hear Mike, of course, over on Sirius XM on their baseball channels, both college and pro. What can you say to the fan that is really frustrated on the Paul Goldschmidt trade at this point in time? Revisionist history. I know they want to see results. They haven't seen results. Where do you put that deal and the players that came back here, and how do they factor in here?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Carson Kelly has been hurt a little bit the last 2 years, and so I think that's probably impacted. I mean, remember in 2019, he had a terrific season. And I think they still view him as, you know, a frontline catcher. I think he's a pretty important guy for them. So, you know, is he a star like Goldschmidt is? No. But is he a good player? I think so. You know, I think in the end they were caught in a spot where, you know, what Goldschmidt was asking for in an extension was not something that ownership or the front office was willing to commit to. And so you had to trade a first baseman who was over the age of 30 at a time when players who are either over the age of 30 or who are over the age of 30 and were first baseman are not valued on the trade market. So I think they made the best deal that they could. I mean, they were trying to get other teams involved, but nobody really was as consistently in there as the Cardinals. The Astros were as well. And actually those trades, I think that trade talks probably came to fruition a little bit with the Greinke deal in terms of some of the players that were involved there. That probably set the table for that. So I think it's, if you're just looking at it as the one-off, does the trade look good for the Diamondbacks? Well, I mean, Paul Goldschmidt's just gone off the last 2 weeks. I think he's knocked in 22 runs in his last 12 games. So, you know, obviously it hasn't looked very good of late. But at the same time, I mean, you have to go with the information that you have at the time. And that was going to be their best bet because it did not seem like either Paul was going to sign an extension here or they were going to get to a number that Paul was comfortable with.
Yeah, and it's the one thing that in my mailbag I keep getting, when's this Goldschmidt trade going to pay off? And I get it from a fan standpoint. I'm glad they're passionate about it.
Your best chance of it paying off is Kelly being healthy. And, you know, Dominic Fletcher was the draft pick that they had. Fletcher's having a very good season this year. And, you know, another left-handed hitting outfielder who can play center field that they have in the organization who, you know, he's the brother of David Fletcher, the Angels shortstop. Mm-hmm. And he is a very good player, too. But, I mean, even when they made the trade, they weren't acquiring guys that were going to be stars. They were acquiring guys that they felt like could be pieces to help them win. They got two major leaguers. Right away, bona fide major leaguers back. If not for the Weaver injury in 19, you know, who knows where this, what that changes for Weaver's outlook. And Kelly has been solid, you know, and it's very difficult to find catching. Yeah. And so the fact that they have a frontline catcher out of it, I mean, is the production as good as what Goldschmidt has provided? No. Is it a total disaster? I don't view it that way.
Last question. That is bigger picture. Is it the Dodgers and Yankees, or do you give the Mets, even though the injury is the front of the rotation? I know we're just 45 games in. We're not to Memorial Day yet. But is it those two and the rest of the field? What do you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Mets are pretty good. I mean, they're really deep position player wise. And the, you know, even when you look at Scherzer and DeGrom being out, I mean, the trio of Carrasco and Bassett and the way Taijuan Walker is pitched gives them a pretty good top three. And then behind that, you've got, you know, David Peterson, who's a pretty solid back end guy. They have a little bit more AAA depth. Trevor Williams, the former Sun Devil, has thrown the ball fairly well in the rotation. Tyler McGill was great before he got hurt. I think he'll be back in relatively short order. So I think the Mets are clearly the class of that division. But listen, the Dodgers are really, really good. And I think the Yankees, I picked the Yankees before the season started, and I caught some flack from my coworkers for it. But they had a lot of guys that like just didn't match the back of their baseball card last year. And that's going to happen. And now you're seeing it. Their starters are very good. Their bullpen, I'm a little bit concerned about between the Chapman injury and the loss of Chad Green for the season. You know, like that's something that they're probably going to have to address, but it's also the easiest thing to address in season. And so I'm a little bit curious to see how that bullpen works, but those three teams are very, very good. And I would put Milwaukee in that mix too. I think Milwaukee is – Milwaukee would not surprise me if they were the only 100-win team in the National League. Part of that is because of the division that they play in. But even with the Freddie Peralta injury, and he's going to miss a significant amount of time, they have two dynamite starters at the front in Burns and Woodruff. And guys like Eric Lauer and Adrian Hauser are extremely underrated. And I think their offense is better than people expect. Those are kind of the four teams that I would have at the forefront right now.
It's good stuff. I love chopping it up with you, and I love hearing you on the air. You do great work. I appreciate your time and insight. Thanks.
Anytime, Brad. Good to see you.
There's Mike Farron, and we're back with more after this timeout.